Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys, and I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter at Joy Keys. Check us out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. You can also email me. I'm SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. Check us out on Spotify. I know that's bad right now, but we're still on there. Stitcher, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, as well as here at Blog Talk Radio. Oh, and we're on Google, so you can check some places out, the shows there. If you miss something or you come in the middle and you think, oh, my God, what did they say in the first 10 minutes? No worries. All the shows are archived. This morning, I have a guest. He's been on here before, and we were talking about another one of his books called The Cosmopolitan Canopy. He is the Sterling Professor of Sociology and of African American Studies at Yale University and one of the leading urban ethnographers in the United States. His publications include Code of the Street, Decency, Violence, and the Moral Life of the Inner City, winner of the Komorowski Award from the Eastern Sociological Society, Streetwise, Race, Class, and Change in the Urban Community, winner of the American Sociological Association Robert E. Park Award for the best published book in the area of urban sociology. And I can go on. He has several other books. Like I said, he was on here and we spoke about The Cosmopolitan Canopy before. And his name is Dr. Elijah Anderson. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on again. Today we're going to be talking about your other book. It's called Black and White Space. Now, what's new? What's going on? Why now? Why are you writing about black and white space? Is there something new that we don't know about? Can you talk to us about this white space? And also you talk about a deep white space.
Yes, yes. Well, I've been very concerned about this issue since I began my work, and many of my works are works that really focus on the issue of systemic racism and the ways in which race works in society. All my books, beginning with A Place on the Corner, where I hung out for 3 years on one street corner in Chicago and wrote A Place on the Corner, and the second one was Streetwise, and then Code of the Street, and then The Canopy, and now this book, and each of these books can be considered a kind of a chapter in my body of work that gives a picture, an ethnographic picture, of the way that race works in American society. And this is like chapter five, in a sense. But it's an independent book, of course. But I deal with the issue of how black people deal with white space. And a lot has happened over the years, of course, since slavery. Slavery itself established the black body at the bottom of the order. And since that time, black people have been trying to get full citizenship, so to speak, to be treated equally in American society, which has been a real, real challenge. As readers, the civil rights was basically, the civil rights movement was basically a statist protest movement for full citizenship and equality. And black people still haven't achieved it, but we've made a lot of strides in the right direction.
Now, what about this deep white space? That was something I hadn't heard that phrase before. Tell the audience what that means compared to just white space.
Well, I mean, basically, white space is a perceptual category, and white space is a space that is predominantly white and controlled by people who are assumed to be white. And another term for it is civil society, or what black people deal with all the time, other minorities as well. Deep white space is space where there are just no black people, and a black person there may be the only one. And so in that kind of situation, a black person is especially needy of support and help typically, and he or she looks for it. When you see another black person, even though you don't know that person, you may nod, you may smile, you may wink, you know, that kind of thing, because you know that you're in that space together. And a black person in that space also looks for allies among white people who give them a nod or a wink, you see. knowing saying that, you know, I know what you're up against, if you know what I mean. And other minorities too, you see. A deep white space is a space that is could be a completely white organization, could be a university, could be a school, could be a neighborhood. It could be upstate New York, upstate Pennsylvania, upstate Maine, where the white people settle, and there are no black people. So if you wander into that place, you feel very much alone and short of help.
Now, you just mentioned I'm sorry, go ahead. What were you going to say?
As a black person, you may feel especially in need of help, so to speak, short of help.
Yes. So you mentioned this nod. And I can tell you, I've used the nod or the glance, not just in the United States, but outside of the United States, where I might have been in a white, I would say deep white space, say like I was in Poland, that I consider that a deep white space, and you see somebody, or I remember being in Italy, and also when I would see a black person, I'd be like, oh, yeah, hey, like, you know, I don't know them. But it is a very comforting thing, and it does happen. And people have done it to me as well to, you know, say, oh, okay, I see you, another black person. Now, you talk about the workspace and black people and white space.
Yes.
In that space, though, sometimes we don't know who our allies are. Like, we could go to lunch with somebody, but we're not going home and we're not having dinner. How can you tell? How do you know who the white ally is?
Yeah, well, that's somewhat difficult to know. You know by the nod, maybe. You know by the wink. You know by the extra help this person provides you. To make you feel comfortable, and that's usually some kind of a tip off. When a white person extends himself above and beyond the call of duty, it's like a tip off. You see. And you see, among white people, there are people who are quote unquote regular white people who basically know very little about black people, and then there are white people who are wise, and to be wise is to be empathetic, to know what a black person is going through. You see, and many white people don't have any clue as to what black people go through in white space, but a white person who has a black child. A white person who has a black spouse, a white person who has people oftentimes have a sense they're kind of edified about the issues that black people face as they go through life. Many white people, probably most white people, have no idea, and they think that black people basically have the same opportunities, the same orientation, the same values they have, and often they do, but there's an extra tax, the black tax that black people know they pay in society. And the white people who befriend black people and extend help, they know that black people pay this black tax as well.
Yes, you talk about the Jewish people and their relationship with African Americans in a certain time in history, because they had been persecuted, so they felt they somehow to some degree understood. So there were a lot of Jewish allies in the civil rights movement.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
So, I mean, this is very true, because of the European issues that Jews face. I mean, a lot of American Jews are empathetic, you know, to what black people are going through, and can sympathize and empathize and even support. And during the civil rights movement, there was a significant number of Jewish people who did reach out. And oftentimes in these corporations, in these universities, what you find sometimes are the people who mentor, black people are oftentimes Jewish. And this is not to say that other whites don't do it, but there's, in many of my interviews, people have noted that this Jewish fellow reached out to him and gave him support when other whites in the company were not even concerned about his situation. So that's an interesting observation, and much of my work is based on interviews and observations that I've been able to make in white space and other spaces in the city of Philadelphia.
Now, did you hear recently that Whoopi Goldberg was talking about the Holocaust and that it didn't have anything to do with race, but then she apologized? What is your opinion, or do you feel comfortable giving your opinion? Was the Holocaust about race or not, for people who may not understand the Holocaust?
Yeah, well, the different notions about race, quote unquote. And in the old days, when people said race, they were talking about, you know, the Jewish race, the Irish race, the Italian race, the Black race. And so race was just another way to speak about ethnicity, in the sense of these divisions that people have between and among themselves, so to speak. And these are, to some extent, socially constructed, as it were. And I think that may have gotten her in trouble, because basically race in the old days was simply a human division that administrators made. So to talk about the race was a way of speaking about the Jewish people, or to speak about even the Black people or whoever they were with respect to these human divisions that administrators made in the old days. So it's complicated, but
yeah,
I sympathize, and I hope the situation is resolved by now.
You have this thing, "Can I help you?" But there's some other meaning there. Can you explain to the audience what the subtext of "Can I help you?" means for African Americans?
Well, I mean, it means many things, and it certainly depends on the context. But oftentimes, Black people who are navigating white space, say they're in a store or in a restaurant or whatever. I mean, people come up right away, "Can I help you?" And they understand from the tone of voice that it isn't always a sincere offer of help, but it's a question about what is your business here? And so Black people have keen antennae, you see, and they have this, and this antennae is on alert in the white space, you know. Black people, they navigate white space. They expect to meet three kinds of white people. They expect to meet white people who mean them well and who may understand. And they expect to meet white people who don't, you see, mean them well. And they expect to meet a wide swath of white people who basically are tolerant towards Black people and maybe can go either way, you see.
Yeah.
But people's antennae, Black people, it's on high alert because they know that the white space, while it could seem pleasant, can turn hostile in any moment, you see. And that's the situation that Black people live under in American society today.
Do you think that Black people, I mean, a majority of Black people are walking around with like PTSD because of this, hypervigilance that we may have to have when we go out into white space, or more so into deep white space? Say you're working on Wall Street, like one of your characters, Carrie, later on in the book. Do you think we have PTSD because of this?
Well, some people do, because the experiences leading up to the PTSD may be different. I mean, the Black people as a group, I mean, it's not a monolithic group, you know, if ever was. I mean, you know, Black people used to be ghettoized. I mean, when they left the plantations of the South and went north, you know, they became ghettoized. Their stigma followed them and preceded them. And very oftentimes, the sundown town said, "Keep on going," you see. But Black eventually settled in areas where they became more and more numerous. And, of course, the white population has always tried to concentrate them, to keep them in that space. And so Black people know that there is this problem of stigma with Black skin. They know that they are different in these spaces. And so they walk around waiting for the hammer to drop sometimes. But at the same time, it's important to understand that not all Blacks come up under oppressive circumstances. There are many Black people who are raised and become socialized and reach maturity in spaces that are really, really open and welcoming to them, you see. And then they go out into the world, and then there's the shock of discrimination, you see.
Yes.
And in my book, I talk about, and this is a trigger warning, I talk about the end moment. And this is the new color line in America. It's a moment of acute disrespect based on one's blackness, and it can come out of the blue and hit you and set you back. The small ones are so many slights that people get all the time, and every group gets, treatment that may mimic the slight or whatever. And these small moments, you say, oh, okay, that's just a matter of living while black. And you keep going because you can't address it because you go crazy trying to address all the slights that happen to you as a black person. But the big one.
Yeah, you talk about that, in the workspace in particular. You're trying to maintain your job and take care of your family, and you don't want to bring up the race card because then you're looked at as, the race guy. And people will treat you differently all of a sudden. Not that they weren't treating you differently already, because that's why you made the complaint. But,
right.
Let me ask you, you had an interesting experience on Amtrak. Oh, go ahead. You were going to say something? Go ahead.
Yeah, just to add something here. Because, this little slight, if you it's just not worth it sometimes to deal with every slight you get. You soon go nuts. But the big ones you have to deal with because they're so consequential. They can make you lose your job. They can make you leave the town. And they can get you fired. They can also get you killed. You see, and that's the big. I just want to talk. Anyway, I discussed this in the book. This moment of acute disrespect based on blackness, and it is, I think, a new American color line. And in the old days, it was bold. People knew just where the line was, and they knew that if they crossed it, they'd have trouble. Today, because of the progress we've made in race relations in terms of civil rights and the incorporation process that has contributed to the largest black middle class in history, that line is blurred, you see, and we can step on it. And it's like the third rail of American race relations. When you step on it, you can be shocked by the reception you get as a black person.
I think my daughter, when she went out to get her first real job, she had been brought up in very diverse, schools, neighborhoods, our friends, relations, with our family. And when she went to her first job, it was a deep white space, because I think she told me it was a handful, like she could count on her hand how many black people were there. And you kind of, she said she learned who they were fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And she was really shocked at the ignorance of the white people in her workplace, from the little things of the hair. From things as suntan, I want to get, so-and-so's color and this and that and the other. I mean, they would make these statements, and she was like, Mom, I can't believe them. I was like, yeah? Like, in my head, I'm like, oh, yeah, I know. But, she's new to it. It was a shock, It was really amazing for me to watch her going through this. I mean, now she has a little tougher skin. But she, because of being brought up in a multicultural, environment, was really shocked, by it. And one of the things you do talk about is Reverend Lowry's statement. If you're light, you're all right. If you're brown, stick around. If you're black, get back. And this is dealing with colorism and how it impacts African Americans and the relations to white space. Tell the audience what that means, if you're light, you're all right, brown, stick around, black, get back, in relation to white space?
Well, I mean, basically, if we go back to slavery, and so much of this begins with slavery, we have to understand slavery on some level to really appreciate current race relations. I think we cannot really understand race relations today without considering the impact of slavery itself, because slavery as an institution established the black body at the bottom of the order. You see, you couldn't have been worse than a black person in the minds of so many white people of that day and time. And Justice Taney, Roger B. Taney, probably said it best when he said, black people have no rights that white people are bound to respect. And he said the Dred Scott decision in 1857, before slaves were emancipated, but he was speaking about the place of black people in American society and in the American estimation, that kind of thing. And so as black people left the plantations and migrated, to towns and cities in the north, as I mentioned, many people said keep on going, but their stigma followed them and preceded them, you see. And of course, as you well appreciate, Joy, I mean, so many of the slave masters had their way with slave women. So this produced brown babies. And of course, you had divisions within the slave plantation between the mulattoes and the dark complexion black people, and the mulattoes were marginally better off in terms of the way the larger society regarded them, you see. And as I say in the book, as black people made their way, the white people in these various towns wanted to contain them and oftentimes told them to keep on going, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Where they settled, these places became the black space, became the ghetto, you see. And so many white people in these areas became socially invested in the lonely place of black people through this principle of white over black. And this became institutionalized and passed on from one generation to the next, to the next, to the next. And of course, within the black community, it's never been a monolith. But there's a sense in which we had the one-drop rule, one drop of black blood and you're black,
mm-hmm.
which radically protected the white race, you see. And but what we have then is that black people, no matter what shade they were all treated as part of the black community, you see. But at the same time, within the black community, we had social stratification and people assumed that they were better off and oftentimes were better off because they could get some of the good jobs, that kind of thing. They built up capital, you know, and that became very, very, very important. In fact, the upper class black community of the 1950s was consistently light complexion. They made up what they called the colortocracy, so to speak. And a lot of the black schools, universities, and what have you, to favor these people, and so they made their way. And they became, of course, the colortocracy. Today, with the incorporation process and behind us, we can see that when that happened through affirmative action, set asides, what have you, the corporations didn't care about skin shade or skin color, they said, at least ostensibly. And so what we had was a kind of integration of black and white people moving, black and brown people, brown black people.
Moving up into the,
And today, in the corporations and in the neighborhoods, there are fewer distinctions between being, black or brown or light, at least administratively in these organizations. Now, socially, these issues still maintain sometimes.
Now, you talk about this issue of gentrification. That's a really big thing on the market right now. I just had Majora Carter on the show the other day, and she talked about self-gentrification, about, people in the community working to stay in the community and develop the community themselves for themselves and so that they don't have to leave and that there's no brain drain. Do you think that it's possible for people to self-gentrificate in terms of that definition, African Americans to self-gentrificate in the ghetto?
Yeah, I like to think that is true, but at the same time, I found in my study that white people have a special power and position, so to speak. Their skin, white skin, is capital, so to speak. And so when white people move into a gentrifying area, they invest not only their money, their resources that way, but they also invest their skin, you see. And that skin is capital. And so when white people move into a ghetto area, it increases in value on the open market, so to speak. Meanwhile, black communities operate solidly black communities operate in a restricted housing market, so to speak. Whereas when white people move into the ghetto becomes an unrestricted housing market, meaning that that the house can then possibly be sold to anybody. In other words, it rises to the level of what the market will bear. But when you have race, when it's just one group of black people in this community, it's a restricted housing market versus the unrestricted housing market. And one of the issues here is white skin as capital. And I deal with this in the book. There's a whole chapter on gentrification and the ways in which this works, so to speak. So these are some of the findings of the book in white space. But I get deep into the social organization of a gentrifying neighborhood in Philadelphia to make sense of this situation.
Yeah, you were talking right. I live right near Hazel and on Pine Street, and I saw complete gentrification on Pine Street. I used to live across of there were like four or five buildings on the other side of the street. They were apartment buildings, and they were mostly, when I first moved in, they were mostly made up of African Americans. So there was a couple, one or two whites or something, but mostly it was African Americans. And I don't know if somebody bought the properties all across the whole block, and they completely redid the whole block. They made these little doggy parks in between. And now, when they first started, it just did this like whitewash. That's the word I would come up with. It was whitewashed. And the rent, the people, the Africans and the other African Americans, they had to move out. I knew some people that lived there, and they were like, they raised the rents like crazy. And they could not stay, but now income or what came in were white people. Can this be a good thing? Can gentrification be good at all, or is it all negative for people of color?
Well, I mean, it doesn't feel very good when it happens to you, you know, kind of thing, when you have to move out because the insurance rates and the taxes have gone up, you know, and you were fine before, but now you have to deal with all this, the newcomers and all. And the newcomers, when they come, the white newcomers, they don't, they kind of bet on, they kind of bargain on the neighborhood changing and becoming more expensive, you know. And sometimes it becomes so expensive that black people can't move in anymore. It becomes white, and then the police services, the police pay more attention to the area, the bicycle racks. And Starbucks might look favorably about that place as a location. Things improve, you see. And for the black people who are there, our life is, maybe a little bit better. But this is a transitional period oftentimes because ultimately they have to deal with it. And some black people benefit because they sell their homes at three times the price that they could get when it was all black, you see. These are some benefits, but ultimately, economics plays a big role, and they're more white middle and upper middle class buyers than there are blacks, and so this is one reason why the neighborhood then becomes whiter and whiter, so to speak.
You have a chapter called The Gym, and I really enjoyed that because we had talked before about your other book called The Cosmopolitan Canopy. And I said to you right before we started, I said, The Gym seems to me like a cosmopolitan canopy. Can you explain to the audience what that means and a little bit about your observations at The Gym?
Sure. Well, the concept of the canopy, the cosmopolitan canopy, is a notion that I introduced in my previous book. And I recommend that the readers, that the listeners check that book out, The Cosmopolitan Canopy. And what the finding was is that in any city, especially Philadelphia, you have a number of what I call cosmopolitan canopies. And these are islands of racial civility located in a sea of segregated living. We still have a very segregated society. Philadelphia is the sixth most segregated city in the country. But there are these spaces where all kinds of people come together and act real nice across racial lines. And the Reading Terminal Market is one of these places. Rittenhouse Square is one of these places. Certain Starbucks, certain restaurants, and on a good day, even Center City, with the synergistic effect of all these canopies working together, becomes a really comfortable place for all different kinds of people, if you will. But as I say in the book, the canopy has fault lines. And one of the most important fault lines is the end moment, or the ways of the times when somebody draws the color line, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an ethnocentric person who does that. But when the color line is drawn, then the canopy can be rented, so to speak, and there can be problems and issues. And the color line is very interesting in the canopy. In the gym, people do get along. I mean, to go to the gym and to, and you got to pay at least $50 a month, maybe more, to go to a good gym. And in this gym, that was about the price. And so this tended to draw in middle-class people, regardless of what color they were. And so that's important. But on the edge of the gym, you had the basketball court, which I found very interesting, because some of the brothers who play basketball, they want a good game, so they bring in their friends from the hood sometimes, you know, and they give them visiting cards, that kind of thing. And the brothers will come in sometimes on a Saturday. They come from the hood, and then they have all the hood paraphernalia with the dance below the butt and the look and the stare and all that. And so it's interesting how the group of basketball players at the hoops, I mean, how they attract the interest of the other participants who sometimes gawk and look, and they're they can see that these brothers who are coming in to play basketball are not like the middle class brothers who and sisters who are normally there, and
they're
very curious. I mean, some of them are upset, but most of them are just kind of curious, and they kind of look and watch, and you know, and the brothers they look directly at the women. They wear their pants below the butt. They don't subscribe to all these niceties that the middle class brothers do and sisters sometimes. And so that's a very interesting thing. But the canopy as a space is a space where all kinds of people, you know, are welcome, so to speak. And people in the canopy are typically on good behavior. But this good behavior, so to speak, is really kind of a veneer. And if you dig deep, you can find the color line. And sometimes that can be quite disturbing. And as I say, it's like a third rail sometimes of American race relations. And then there's a shock, and somebody gets the end moment, so to speak. But as I've said in my book, anybody who's different, anybody who's marginalized, can get this end moment. And they don't always call it that, but it's a moment of acute race, acute disrespect based on one's particularity. And Black people get it because of the hood being so close to so many of these canopies, so to speak, and people associating Black people in the canopy with the hood. And some of these people who are there in the canopy may not be from the hood, but people just see Black skin, and their Black skin becomes kind of a master status that gives them that identity. But this is all laid out in my book, The Cosmopolitan Canopy, and to some degree in the new book, Black and White Space.
You know, Carrie, that chapter is a really interesting. I actually, after reading that chapter, I actually called my mom, and because I was just so intense. This is a chapter where you devote to this one particular individual, and I would say the backflips and all the different things he had to do to conform or feel, I guess, I don't know, equal, desired, comfortable in the white space. Learning, reading books and changing his watch and all these things, and yet he had different trauma going on when he came back to the Black space. Another thing that you talked about is sometimes people, I guess, riling against the system, and they may not be from the ghetto, but they'll dress and act like they are, one, to be accepted in the ghetto, maybe by their fellow Black people, but also to kind of rile against the white space, like kind of shake it up. You want to talk about that a little bit and what that means? Now we see on TV and songs that that image of the quote-unquote ghetto is selling and people are making money out of it.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Well, you probably know about The Wire, you know, kind of thing. And,
oh, yeah.
And a lot of people love that program, and some people don't like it so much. You know, years ago, the Atlantic Monthly, they asked me to comment about The Wire. And at the time, I said, well, I've never seen The Wire. And the guy said, but you're lying. Yeah, I said, you never watched The Wire? I said, no. And he said, well, would you watch it? And then let me interview you. And so I got some back orders of the episodes, and I got into it. I got quite intrigued, really, when I got into it. And I watched it. And then about 6 months later, whatever, he came back and said, well, what'd you think? I said, well, it's a very gripping program and very engaging, you know, and I liked it, you know. But, you know, they left one thing out. He said, what's that? I said, they left out the decent people. you know, my field work, and I've been all in the hood, and your Code of the Street, if you read that, you read all about the issues and all of this. I've been going into all kinds of spaces and really getting to know a lot of different kinds of people in the hood. And what I've come to see is that most people in the hood are decent and trying to be decent, you know, like Little House on the Prairie, but only in the city, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there are just a tremendous number of decent families and decent people, you know. But the wider society doesn't always appreciate that, you see. And I told this to the interviewer, I said, well, you know, it's an interesting program. I liked it. But they left one thing out, the decent people, you see. And see, that's the thing, the street element, the crime, the violence, the sells, you know. And the Little House on the Prairie image of black people doesn't sell because a lot of white folks don't even know this image, if you know what I mean. This is hidden, made invisible by the issues that we ascribe, you know, to the streets and to the ghetto, from the drugs and the crime and this and that. I mean, this obscures the decent people, if you know what I mean. And society seems to be really interested in this mayhem and the killing and the code and all that. Denzel Washington, you may recall, got an Oscar not long ago.
Oh, God, yes. Not his
brilliant work.
No, right? I mean, so many other things that he did. I mean, Malcolm X was like a masterpiece. So many other films that he did, and he didn't win an Oscar, and then he wins an Oscar for that. And then also Halle Berry, she won an Oscar for Monsters Ball, which I was like, oh, what happened to her Darcy Dandridge film? What happened to so many other things? So, you know, people are fascinated and think that is who we are, but we're not a monolith. And I think, you know, now with this, people are boycotting and banning books of, you know, critical race theory or African-American history being taught in schools. So how can you dispel these myths if they won't let in the truth?
Absolutely. That's a great question. Well, I mean, basically in the book, I talk about the iconic ghetto, you know. And this is the image that is in the minds of a lot of people, the iconic ghetto. And, of course, this iconic ghetto can be traced right to slavery. And the iconic ghetto, and the point is that the ghetto, so to speak, is no longer simply a physical space. It's become an icon, an image, a symbol. And this operates on race relations. It hovers over race relations between blacks and whites who don't know each other. And basically, the white community and others who are middle class or what have you oftentimes relegate black people to the iconic ghetto, because that iconic ghetto is simply not the physical ghetto anymore. But it's a great source of stereotype and prejudice and discrimination. And a lot of people buy into that. And so I think this explains why Denzel Washington got the Oscar for the Training Day, and other people get, laureated for their roles as well. And paid attention to when they exhibit or or connect with the iconic ghetto, which is all about the stereotypes of the bad black, the big black and scary male, that kind of thing, or the welfare queen. And these are big stereotypes in American society, and a lot of people buy into that when they think about black Americans, you see. And this is relevant to the discussion about Denzel and Halle Berry.
Well, I thank you so much, you know, for coming on. We've run out of time. We could continue to talk for another hour or two, but thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for writing the book. I think it will be helpful. And I think that both sides of the color line need to read it. It's not just for black people. I think it's for everybody to read and understand the context in which things happen and how they impact both parties, you know, black and white, or in society. So thank you so much for writing your book. I'm going to give away some copies of your book to the audience.
Great. Well, Black and White Space was just a real eye-opener for me. I mean, I enjoyed doing it, and I learned a lot. And the findings, I think, have implications for how we live our lives. And if more people were edified by points I make in the book, I think we'd be better off as a society. So thank you for having me on.
Thank you again for taking the time. You can go back to sleep, and you can eat your waffles or pancakes or whatever you do on your Saturday mornings and relax if possible. Thank you again, Doctor, for coming on the show. You have a great weekend, okay?
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former